Bandwidth for this podcast is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is the iPhone Alley Podcast, episode 59 for October 19th, 2009. I had coffee today. All right, it is time for the iPhone Alley Podcast. I'm Michael Johnston, and we're here to talk about all things iPhone, iPod Touch, the App Store, all that great stuff. Tonight with me, as always, is Mr. Jeff Gamet from the Mac Observer. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, and as always, I am so fracking excited to be here, really.
You know, I'm thinking at some point we're going to have a show where you're not here for the intro, so I can't say, as always, and then you appear. And then we all moan and we all, oh, Jeff's back.
Yeah, well, yeah, it could be like a surprise walk-on.
Well, yeah, exactly. You
know, and it's special... the happy show, and there's ponies and cake and balloons.
Well, those come in with you, right? That just automatically gets wheeled out when you appear.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Adam Christensen from the MacCast also gets a bunch of ponies and cake and streamers and all that great stuff when he comes out to join us. Hello, Adam, how are you?
And I'm de-Cylon-fied.
Yeah.
Is that how you say that?
I think so.
Hopefully no more Cylon noises. And again, apologies to everybody for destroying last week's show.
Oh, it sounded fine. We're just glad that you're back to your normal velvety quality.
Yeah, I have no idea. Something strange was going on that day because I went to upload my show and my upload bandwidth was just junk. And I tried everything, resetting the router and all the normal troubleshooting steps. And I'm thoroughly convinced that Cox was up to something, you know, moving routers around or something on their end. And it just killed my upstream bandwidth, which was weird because downstream was totally fine. So who knows?
Hmm.
Well, Adam, think about what the singular of that company's name is. And that probably,
I don't know. I don't want to go down a whole rat hole at the beginning. But, you know, bandwidth in the U.S. is just overall is a problem.
True that.
Yeah. So we'll just leave it at that.
Okay, cool. All right. So let's get right into the iPhone stuff. I think the big headline of the week is probably that Apple has decided to allow in-app purchases for free applications. And so when Apple rolled out or announced the in-app purchases earlier this year, I guess, for 3.0, they said that you could only have in-app purchasing in an application that is a pay app. And the reasoning behind that wasn't too clear to me. It was very vague, and they just kind of said, well, you know, you don't want to trick users into thinking, you know, here's a free application and download it. Oh, you have to pay something. For those who don't know, the in-app purchasing was a response to, you know, Apple's response to developers, you know, needing some way to add content to certain applications. And this is just kind of like a unified way of letting everybody do it. It's really simple. It's kind of just, it's just a little API, and it links up to your iTunes account, just in the way that it works for purchasing applications. So now, I guess is the big deal that we can finally do away with light apps and just all apps are shareware that need to be that way?
Well, I'm curious. So, I mean, can we really, or... I guess I really don't understand the full functionality of, or all that's possible with in-app purchases. Because to date, I mean, what we've seen is you buy an app, and, you know, my classic example right now is this RampChamp. You know, you buy some additional levels, and it kind of plugs into the existing game. Because I know another complaint is, you know, developers, what if I want to come out with a new version and I want to have people pay for it? Does this open up that possibility? Or I thought there was some restrictions. Like, Michael, didn't you say there was something weird around, like, subscriptions aren't really subscriptions in the classic sense that we would think of subscriptions? I think you had told me that.
I remember that too. And it's like the way subscriptions are set up in the App Store. They're designed to work primarily for, say, like game developers that want to sell you levels.
Right, yeah.
But where you'd really want to really, really have a subscription for a periodical, a magazine, a newspaper, whatever.
Or in the case of like, you know, something like, you know, tweet push or anything. So essentially it's not...
That's the example you gave me.
Yeah. So it's not a subscription. They can't actually do subscriptions through the in-app purchasing. I'm sure a developer could set that up and do something that Apple wouldn't like. But the way in-app purchasing is supposed to work is it's a... you know, a one purchase thing. So if it needs to be done regularly, well, then you have to manage that yourself. You have to keep buying, you know, if for example, with Tweet Push, it's, you get 30 days per 99 cents.
But you have to go back and remember to buy another 30 days.
Yes. And according to Jay Snell on Twitter, the way the, app purchasing works, the in-app purchasing is, there's an API call, to verify that an item has been purchased with Apple's servers. So Apple, you know, keeps track of, you know, whatever you say, you know, this person is purchasing, then Apple tells the application, yes, this person has that, go ahead and unlock that feature. And so that's kind of how it, you know, it goes in between that, that sort of interesting, you know.
Yeah. So what I'm wondering is, so can you have a bunch of features in there, in the case of a, say, a free app that you want to be a trial, and then be like, okay, after 30 days, if you want this thing to still work, you've got to,
you know, I'm not sure about time limited applications. The way, you know, from the press release, it says you can simplify your development by creating a single version of your app that uses in-app purchase to unlock additional functionality, eliminating the need to create light versions of your app.
Right. Then can you push new functionality, or in the case of the other one is, and I know a lot of developers really want Tweety, with Tweety 2 is a classic example. You now have two versions basically, you know, and Tweety, like we were talking earlier, doesn't go away when you buy Tweety 2. You're just buying a different, really what it amounts to, a different app. Could they actually say, okay, pay the upgrade fee, you know, upgrade fee, $2.99 in app, and I'm going to push you a whole new version of the app that will replace it? Or does all that functionality need to be already in the app? And if it already has to be in the app and it can only be unlocked, that's still kind of somewhat limiting from a developer's perspective in my mind.
I don't know
how it works. And so just to be clear, everything I'm saying right now, I'm just speculating on, wondering how it works.
Yeah, I don't know how... in-app purchase would work for situations like Tweety 2, or, you know, just in general, you know, pay for upgrades. In the case of RampChamp, I do know that you have to download the, you know, additional content, and that really makes sense with how Apple initially set it up. So, you know, they say, you know, you can use in-app purchase to unlock additional functionality. Whether or not that functionality comes with the app package that you download from the App Store initially for free, or what have you, I assume that's up to the developer. And in that case, it I'm sure it differs depending on, you know, what kind of content it is. If it's a game, then it's probably fairly easy to just keep that package small and say, you know, here it is the you know, the light version. It has one level in there. Go nuts. And if you want to do the in-app purchase, you know, you have to download,
that'll get you the rest,
whatever,
of the
rest of the levels,
or whatever.
Levels, yeah. But if it's a utility application, for example, and you only get, you know, so much access, I assume that that can be placed in the application itself. Although, you know, who knows how that's going to work with app pirating. I wonder if this is going to aid in that or affect it at all.
Even if it gets rid of just the, you know, games where you have to have a free or a light version separate from the other one, that's going to go a long way to cleaning up the App Store. Now, question is Apple going to roll back as all those light versions like fall away? Are they going to be happy with a quarter of going from 85,000 apps on the store to 65,000?
Oh, that's funny. I did not think about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I do know that you know, Layton over at Polar Bear Farm changed the pricing of Tweet Push from, you know, the initial 99 cents, which gets you a month for Tweet Push. It's free now. You can get Tweet Push for free, and it gives you 14 days use.
I've seen
a lot of applications hours after the announcement, even. You know, that already have push, you know, in-app in-app purchasing set up in the application. They just, you know, they all slashed the prices and, you know, went to free. And, you know, for those kind of service-based applications, they did that.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's a good... So to answer the initial question is yes. This is, I think this is a great thing that it's now open to free, and it's certainly going to simplify and reduce the number of apps in the store. I just wonder how Apple's going to be... Apple marketing is going to have to hold off for a little while and not really probably announce their numbers anymore.
You know, yeah, exactly. Well, now that also brings up another point, though. One, you know, if you go to download, you know, XY game, and you've already purchased, you've downloaded it, you said, I like the content, I want to buy more levels or what have you. Later you delete that game and you want it back. And that's it's a fairly common thing that you go and you download something over the air, you know, later after the fact, after you've purchased it. I'm wondering if that's going to complicate things, adding more steps to purchasing, mm-hmm. you know, that game again, or if Apple will automatically, because, in-app purchase is tied to your account already, I wonder if they'll just give you that content back to begin with. I do know in RampChamp, there's a button below the packs that says, you know, check to see if you have any, previously purchased packs. But I'm not sure if Apple can automatically push that down with a re-download.
Or is that something that a developer has to put in? I was going to ask you about that because, I've been having battery issues with my iPhone, and I haven't done any in-app purchases yet.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the fixes that they told me to do, in addition to, you know, doing the classic of run the battery down to nothing and then recharge it, but they also said, restore the iPhone, but don't restore your backup.
Right, yeah.
Which, that's where all of the, you know, extra content and levels. The bummer about doing that is every time I do that, I lose all this saved data that's in all my applications. And I have to, you know, start over from scratch. And you can't bring that back if you don't bring it back with your backup. And I wondered about in-app purchase stuff. It's like, well, you know, am I going to lose any in-app purchase stuff and then not be able to get it back? Is the only way to get that stuff back, restore from download? So it's good to hear that at least developers, you know, might have an option to allow a re-download or check for prior purchase content and resuck that back down.
Yeah, referring back to Jason Snell's tweet, you know, that's just an API call with Apple to, you know, say, you know, did he already get this? Yeah, okay, go ahead. It's interesting to think how, how Apple treats that additional content. You're also talking about backups, and I wonder, you know, if you download a game that has one level and then you purchase the, you know, let's say 30 more levels, will that be part of your backup now? Because I know that, you know, they definitely sync over the applications, but that's a one-time thing for every version. I'm wondering, you know, how that's going to change. I mean, certainly restoring from a backup, if you purchased a lot of, in-app purchase games with lots of levels and stuff like that, that's going to, you know, take up, you know, if you restore a phone, for example, and you then put all of that information back on there, you're going to have, you know, a ton of other stuff that, you know, until you put those apps back on, just remains, app data until you put the app on and then delete it, for example. That's how you get rid of it. But I feel like this is, going to cause, you know, some more, interesting issues for Apple to work through, in the coming months now that they've done this, because it's going to be much more widely used. And I also wonder how that's going to work for developers giving out promo codes to test applications. So if Chilingo, for example, decides to, you know, pull all of their, you know, pay apps and say, here are all just, you know, it's all free. You just pay for the extra content, how that's going to work with reviewers, because you can't give a promo code out for in-app purchase content.
Right. Yeah, maybe it will depend on how the application is set up. Meaning, is it an application where everything is there? Like in the case of a game, maybe it has 30 levels. And when you buy the game or get the light version for 99 cents, the first two levels are unlocked. But then you pay the the upgrade fee or subscription fee, whatever you want to call it, and then it just unlocks the rest of the content that's in the app. I can see where that would work easy for reviewers, because then they could potentially get the review license code for the full version instead of the light version. But yeah, when it comes to going to download.
I mean, if they eliminate their pay for apps that have all of the content in there, you know, then and they're all free with, you know, in-app purchase only, then you can't give out a promo code for that extra content, at least not yet.
Right.
So, it would also, I think, make sense down the line for Apple to maybe give you two buttons for an application that maybe says, you know, one says download now for free, or, you know, in addition to that, you can buy the app with the extra content. It'll be interesting to see how Apple does this, and, you know, how developers respond to it. You know, we initially saw a lot, like I said, we saw a lot of developers immediately change their pricing models with, you know, applications that already have, you know, in-app purchasing for service-based apps. But it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the adoption rate of this is going to be, and, you know, how that causes Apple to change their models in the App Store. I've had a lot of coffee, by the way.
Go you, Michael.
I know. I got up, I got hydrated, I had a lot of coffee, so I'm talking.
And that's okay, because...
that's what we're here for.
Yeah, and we can listen to you talk all night.
Well, I'm going to have to take a break at some point. Should we talk about AT&T talking about tethering? AT&T has publicly now said, we never said that you'd get tethering by the end of 2009. According to 9to5 Mac, at some point they mentioned that they heard, I think in an interview with AT&T's mobility CEO and Mike Arrington, that the CEO said, and this is back in 2008, that tethering would be enabled for the iPhone on AT&T's network in 2009. So we all assumed that, sure, it could be, you know, December 31st, but, you know, sometime in 2009. So that's where they're getting that from. And, you know, they've come back and said to 9to5 Mac, you know, we never announced that. Where did you, they just said, you know, where did you see that? Because we want you to take it off your site. and if you don't know, you know, AT&T right now allows tethering for most of their phones, you know, the phones that are at least hardware capable of doing that, most of their smartphones. But of course, you know, we get special treatment from AT&T because we're iPhone users. And by special, I mean we get, you know, we don't get as many fun stuff, as many fun things as, you know, everybody else, like MMS and now tethering. It obviously works. And, you know, 9to5 Mac was quick to point that out, that, you know, we've been using tethering since, you know, we could jailbreak, and now we're using it on our 3.0 phones and we're not updating, and we've, you know, we're using the exploit to do that. And of course it works. But I think, you know, obviously AT&T's concern is that, you know, with all the iPhones and all the potential traffic that they would incur on their 3G network would just bring it to its knees, especially in places like San Francisco and New York, you know, where the network is pretty bad already. And I guess that, you know, at some point one listener pointed out for us that MMS does exist on a different band. It uses a different part of, you know, that signal. It doesn't use the 3G signal. It uses the SMS portion for that. So, you know, MMS obviously could have, you know, hurt the network as much as, you know, they were anticipating it might if they ruled it out immediately. But it's, you know, I guess we're waiting for AT&T to get their 3G network up to a point where they feel it could support tethering. And right now that seems pretty far off still, even with, I mean, how's the traffic with you, Adam? Because you're in, you know, you're in California.
I haven't noticed any issues any more than already existed.
Okay.
prior to that rolling out, I do have a feeling if tethering were to roll out, you know, tethering's, I think the big thing behind tethering is you know, are they going to hold off so that they can release it and have it at a price point that is similar to the other devices that they offer it for? And I can't remember how much it is for other devices. I want to say 20 or 30 bucks on a BlackBerry. Is that?
That sounds about right. It sounds about right. Yeah. $20 or $30 is what I thought.
Extra. You know, I always maintained they could bring it out early to appease everybody and just make it really expensive.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
$50 or $60. And, you know, maybe they don't want to do that. Maybe they're obviously very concerned. I mean, they've said it publicly that they're concerned. I think there were some statements. I talked about this on my show a couple episodes ago. There were some conflicting statements between the CEO of AT&T, I think it was, and the, you know, the technical the guy that was heading up the VP of whatever the technical division would be,
okay,
saying, you know, our network is good because, you know, the ads had come out saying you know, I think somebody's running ads basically alluding that the AT&T network is really stinky. And I think it's that company with the V in their name.
Oh, the Fogons.
Yeah. And the CEO was saying, you know, basically the small percentage of there's a small percentage of smartphones out there. He didn't specifically name the iPhone, but we kind of knew what he was talking about, who are using up all of our data network. And those guys have to be managed, basically. Or we have to figure out a way to manage our network, was how he specifically put it. He was very careful in his wording, but it was pretty obvious that he was saying, basically, iPhones are eating up all the data network, and, you know, it is causing a problem for our engineers, and we have to figure out how to deal with this. So it does not surprise me that they're not doing tethering this year. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they wait and don't give it to anybody till it's their 4G network.
Yeah. This whole thing doesn't surprise me at all. Actually, I think it highlights a problem with all the cell carriers, which is when you have devices that are, in the grand scheme of things, more difficult to use, you have fewer people that are going to really take advantage of the features. So then it becomes easier to oversell your capacity, because you know you're never going to have enough people using those features to tax the system. Well, then the iPhone comes out, and it's immediately a problem because you can actually use all those features. Right. And now AT&T is scrambling to catch up. And if the other cell carriers are smart, they're doing the same thing before they end up with that same egg on their face.
Well, and, you know, a comment I want to make here that is starting to really bug me is everybody, you know, at least in the U.S., there's a lot of people that are saying, well, if it'll just go to Verizon, you know, Verizon's got the better network and they can handle it and blah, blah, blah. If Verizon had the same uptake that AT&T had with the, you know, iPhone, so let's go back and say Verizon got the iPhone contract and AT&T didn't, I do not think Verizon's network would be doing any better, really, than AT&T's network is doing right now. I think they'd be having exactly the same issues and trying to manage the thing in pretty much the same way.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Just, I mean, that's my opinion. But I think AT&T was just totally blown away. I think they just did not realize, you know, the impact an incredible device like the iPhone was going to have. I mean, when you have, Jeff hit nailed it. I mean, when you have a device that's that usable on the data, it's not, you know, easy to use and uses data in the way that the iPhone does. It's not surprising. I mean, I use my iPhone for everything. I'm on that data network more than, you know, probably 10 times more than I am on any of the voice stuff. And before that, you know, my phone was voice only.
Yeah, I think I'm the same way. Of course, I came from a Razor.
Yeah, me too.
And yeah, okay, so we're in the exact same boat. So we used a phone that had crap for data coverage, but it made phone calls just fine. And then you get the iPhone, and suddenly your desk is in your pocket, and you have all of these incredibly powerful features that are usable, and you use them. And I found my iPhone to be a very liberating device because I can throw it in my pocket and I don't have to spend every moment of every day sitting at my desk making sure everything that needs to happen does. I can do that from the car, from the coffee shop, whatever. And so I do. And yeah, for me, the iPhone is more of a data tool than a phone tool, although I do make calls on it occasionally too.
Now, I wonder if this, I feel like this kind of goes into, you know, sort of the net neutrality thing that's going on. So the FCC, have they ruled on net neutrality yet? Are they still discussing that? I haven't been keeping
up. As far as I know, they're still discussing, but they've made it very clear what the end result is going to be, which is they're going to implement some kind of net neutrality rule that impacts the wireless carriers.
Yes, and the big, you know, we definitely talked about this at some point on the show, and the big, you know, the highly discussed problem with net neutrality being enforced on wireless carriers is that they don't have the same kind of infrastructure as, you know, wired ISPs have, and it could potentially be a problem for wireless carriers. And I do you think that net neutrality would affect iPhone tethering?
It wouldn't surprise me.
So, I mean, do you think that that would, you know, push AT&T into enabling it for any device that supports it?
No, I think it would push them into stopping adding additional support for features.
Okay, so they would get around the fact that, you know, their network can be used for everything by, you know, not. I mean, they don't keep you from visiting certain sites. You know, it doesn't really seem like there are a lot of net neutrality issues happening right now on wireless carriers, aside from the fact that they tend to limit some features. And I wonder if the net neutrality, stuff will require the carriers to allow that kind of traffic.
Yeah, maybe, but if the feature isn't available on the phone, and of course we can say, but it is, AT&T just doesn't allow us to have it. But if the feature isn't available on the phone, and for all practical purposes, the iPhone does not have tethering right now, by saying, well, look, you know, the feature's not there, you can't use it, I don't see how that would have a big impact on what's going on with net neutrality.
Okay.
But I'm not a lawyer, although I have played one on stage before, but that still doesn't qualify me to give a definitive answer. But that's how it looks to me.
Adam, you want to weigh in?
No, the whole net neutrality thing confuses me.
All right, fair enough.
I don't know. I don't know how net neutrality plays into it. The one thing I'm thinking the whole time, though, you know, because we're talking kind of bandwidth and things like that. You know, this AT&T has that new one of those things called that you can put in your house now and can act as a 3G hotspot or whatever.
That thing.
Why aren't they giving those things away? like shift their 3G traffic in small areas or at offices and stuff like that over to the you know, their competitors.
Yeah. It's
because it plugs into your broadband. And I'm pretty sure at that point, like once you hit that base station with your 3G, it's going out, you know, your calls are going out over your internet service provider's line and not AT&T's
right.
line.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that's
why are they charging for that? They should be like paying people, like put these in everywhere.
Yeah.
And make them open and let everybody to, you know, within, they work in a small range. I think it's, you know, like a Wi-Fi base station kind of range, but you know, it could solve some of their bandwidth issues.
It'd solve a lot of their bandwidth issues. Yeah.
They could say, all right, so if you want to keep this as a private thing for your own family and friends, then it's going to cost you $100 for the box. I think they charge $150.
Yeah, right? I think it's $150, and so, I think it's open to everybody. When it works.
Control it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it works just like your Wi-Fi router. You can lock it down or not lock it down. Or
right. So exactly. You would say,
you know,
only these.
AT&T could say, look, if you take this for free, it has to stay open. And then, of course, they have some firmware thing that prevents you from locking it down.
Sure.
Right.
And then they have all these mini cell towers all over the whole country. And, I mean, if they
mesh network of these things, yeah.
Yeah, if they were giving them away for free, I'd go ahead and put one on my network. I don't care. But, yeah.
Me too.
And so there's all these people that are like us that would totally put one on if we didn't have to pay for it and just leave it open. It'd be my little contribution back to the cell phone community.
Well, what's the coverage of one of those microcells?
I don't think, like I said, I think it's like Wi-Fi range. So, you know, 150 feet.
I wonder if that would that mitigate the problem very much at all for AT&T? I mean, maybe
only if you had them everywhere, you'd have
right.
to get
so
everybody
if you're giving
with Wi-Fi router in a neighborhood. You know, But you could blanket a neighborhood. If every house in a neighborhood had one of these things attached to their Wi-Fi network, why not?
Right. And then just think of high congestion areas, like a downtown metro area with apartments and offices that right. have all these things. I mean, you could stand on any street corner and have a solid signal because you're just hitting the little boxes. And I think it's crazy. None of us can remember what they're called right now.
The microcell.
Microcell. Yeah, that's it.
Microcell.
Maybe the hardware is just, you know, too darn expensive. It probably is. It probably costs them maybe more than $150 even to get the hardware. Maybe it's a net zero thing for them. And again, they're probably thinking also the other side of this is when I'm at home, I'm on my Wi-Fi on my iPhone anyway. I'm not typically on 3G. So.
Well, okay. And I think we mentioned at some point that you can take these things with you, but I'm looking at their site right now and it says going on a trip, see if you have coverage based on your device itinerary, device and itinerary. So it seems like I'm trying to figure out what they're kind of trying to promote. If they're saying, well, you should take one of these with you depending on how your coverage is, or you have to have some kind of, it's dependent on the location of the device in some way.
Well, I know the initial setup is dependent on the location of the device because they're doing a very controlled rollout. So what I understand, it's just like a handful of cities right now.
Yeah.
But from what I understand, once that device is properly configured, as long as you have an internet connection, a broadband internet connection that you can hook that box up to, you have AT&T coverage. Okay. So, but maybe right now they're doing a thing where they're restricting it only to those cities where it's active, because it does have some type of GPS unit in it, so it knows where it's at.
Yeah.
And maybe once they finish the rollout, then they'll shut that thing off, so you can just take it any damn place you want and go.
It's interesting. I wonder why they would be keeping it so concentrated on a few different areas.
My guess would be because something isn't working and they don't want to have the entire country bitching about whatever is broken right now. So they're doing this in very controlled areas where they can hammer out those issues. Maybe it's a scaling issue that they're trying to hammer out right now.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, is it available in your area?
Oh God, no.
And what about you, Adam? You're in California.
Yeah. I haven't checked.
I'm sure it is.
It was $150, so I immediately discounted it.
Well, if you get one of those, wireless repeaters, they're about $150.
Yeah.
So who knows?
I don't know. I got my AirPort, Extreme, and it covers my whole house, and I'm happy.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on, Apple may enable some dormant FM technology in the iPhone 3GS and the newer iPod Touches. And I did some research on this before I decided to talk about this piece. But essentially, 9to5Mac is reporting that Apple is currently working on Nano right now that has the FM tuner in it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So
I have one. It's nice.
Yeah. So, yeah, we talked about it, actually. Yeah. So, rumor has it, according to 9to5Mac, that they're working on an iPhone OS version of that application to take advantage of what is supposedly in the current iPhone hardware. They say that the biggest problem with that right now that they're working on is actually getting it to work with the iTunes store that's currently on the phone. Because a lot of radio stations now tag songs that are playing. And I think with the Nano, right, you can say, I like this song, and it'll tell you about that when you sync your Nano, right? So you can purchase it.
Yeah, it actually creates a playlist in the store section called Tagged. And anything that you've tagged when you're listening to the radio will show up there and gives you a link to the store to buy that track or that album.
Gotcha. Yeah. So they're trying to get that so it's directly integrated into the iTunes application on your phone. Now, to me, that's really cool. But even cooler is, and I guess we either missed this or I personally don't remember, but supposedly the chipset in the current iPhone 3GS and all the the models after that have the potential to receive FM. Now, with the latest iPod Touch, that also supposedly has the potential for broadcasting FM as well. You know, the use for that would be for, you know, playing audio through your car stereo or what have you. But, you know, 9to5 was quick to point out that the iPod Touch, the second generation iPod Touch, had the potential to, it had a Bluetooth chip in it, but it didn't work for 9 months from its initial launch until Apple decided to enable it to work with the Nike Plus, right? With 3.0?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was 3.0 when they turned that on.
Yeah, so do you get, I mean, I like I said, I did some research on this and I looked, iFixit has the, you know, the Broadcom chip model number there. Don't remember off the top of my head, but I looked that up and it definitely is in the spec for that chip to have an FM tuner on it. So,
all right. So here's my question about that. And okay, keep in mind, I am not an electrical engineer. So this might be very obvious to someone that knows how to hook wires together, but you need to have an antenna to get good reception. On the Nano, you have to plug in your headphones to have, yep, and use that as your good antenna.
Gotcha.
Now I'm assuming that there are contacts coming off of the headphone jack that link back up to the chip somehow, so that you have that good signal strength. So has someone actually looked at the guts of the new iPhone and the new iPod Touch to see if it has the appropriate type of contacts to allow that antenna thing to happen?
Or whether or not the existing antennas in the phone, you know, allow that. Because, you know, both the Touch and the phone, you know, the Touch has, you know, Wi-Fi antennas in there. And the phone, of course, has, you know, tons of antennas for GPS and Wi-Fi and mobile and all that.
Well, and yeah. I'll tell you another problem with the Nano related to what Jeff is talking about is if you use a higher quality set of headphones or earbuds or something like that, the reception's not as good.
Yeah, because they're insulated better.
Yeah, there's better shielding. So the white earbuds work but much better for radio reception than, you know, say something that has a, you know, I use over-the-ear headphones that I like that have big, thick, you know, heavy cords on them, you know, typically like with quarter inch to eighth inch adapters, and those, you know, the FM radio really does not come in well at all.
You get fancy with that, huh?
Well, it's weird to have big old honking headphones in a little tiny device, but they're just more comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I'm working all day than the earbuds typically tend to be.
Okay, so how long before someone makes a high quality set of shielded headphones that have an antenna sticking off of them, like they had back in the 70s where you could dial your earphones? Yeah.
Yeah. So will the radio work at all if you don't have headphones plugged in? Does it say
you
plug them in?
Yep.
Huh. Interesting.
Okay. Now that's weird, because when I have played with them in the Apple Store without any headphones plugged in, I was able to tune in radio stations.
Were they plugged into a power?
It goes through the dock connector as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I had pulled it out of the dock connector.
Oh, you're smart.
Might be your market too.
That could be.
So were you in downtown Denver?
No, I was actually I was in Broomfield. I was at the Flatiron Crossing Mall. So everyone can Google the location, but it was the Apple Store in the Flatiron Crossing Mall. So I was actually inside the mall. Huh. Surrounded by all the other stores and the rest of the structure, and they were picking up radio stations. So I don't know, maybe Apple has some kind of FM radio repeater in the stores now too. I don't know.
Yeah, I did not have good luck without headphones ever.
Okay, so it doesn't keep it from you, keep you from doing it, but it certainly works better.
Well, and the problem with the headphone thing too is that you know, the speakers aren't great, but the Nano has a speaker. So you can actually play music and you can hear music without anything connected, but you can't really tune it. I have not had success tuning an FM radio and listening to it through the built-in speaker, because I can't get a signal. And you have to plug the headphones in at which point it disables the speaker. And, you know, there you go. Yeah. So I kind of wish there was a way to force the speaker to go on even when the headphones were connected, because then you could actually, you know, use it almost like a little transmitter, you know, transistor radio.
Right.
Back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, moving on to some, you know, more businessy topics. Art Levinson has stepped down from the board at Google, severing the last, you know, board tie that Apple and Google had. If you guys remember, Eric Schmidt, Google's CEO, was on the board at Apple for quite some time. And of course, he popped up and made an appearance during the initial iPhone announcement to talk about Google Maps on the iPhone. And, you know, of course, we all enjoy that on our phones. And have we discussed this on the show? I feel like we haven't talked about the FTC, you know, investigating, you know, the fact that there's, you know, crossover between these two boards, because, you know, now they're, you know, they both kind of work in the same space as far as, you know, mobile devices, you know, with the iPhone and, you know, the Android, as well as, you know, the Google Voice stuff.
And don't forget web browsers.
And web browsers, yeah. Google Chrome and Safari, yeah. Well, although, you know, they both use WebKit, but yeah. So, you know, earlier they, you know, Google's CEO said that, you know, Art Levinson would not be, you know, stepping down, but he decided to do that. And I think that's probably the best move. To me, the first thing I think is, you know, what's going to come of that relationship between Apple and Google? Because I think we discussed this last week, you know, how much we enjoy having Google Maps, you know, having Google and Apple play nice on certain ideas and applications. We don't want to lose Google Maps.
You know, I am not buying into the whole thing about Apple and Google are fighting and bitch slapping and all of that. I think what's going on with all of the little breakups, so to speak, it's just the companies doing what is appropriate to stay in compliance with federal regulations and proper board policies and all of that stuff. So the having to choose which board these people are going to serve on, I mean, that was a given from my perspective.
Kind of splitting it.
Yeah, and the directions that they went was no surprise to me either.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Of course, Eric Schmidt's going to stick with the Google board.
Of course.
And then Arthur Levinson, okay, he can go either way, but it makes more sense for him to stick with the Apple board.
Yeah, because he's CEO of Genentech, and they've, I believe they've been featured, you know, several times, you know, talking about how they use all the Apple technology at Genentech.
Yeah, and then he also served for a few years on Apple's board before joining the Google board.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. I think that we're going to continue to see Apple and Google work together, although we may not see the same, you know, spotlight on the Google stuff that we've seen in the past, simply because if you're highlighting what the two companies are doing so closely, that often you'll probably keep that government regulatory watch thing going on, and neither company wants that. Not that they're doing anything wrong, I think. It's just if you can avoid having government regulators breathing down your neck all the time, it's a lot easier to do your job.
Yeah. Jeff has kind of nailed it. I think the deal is this is just, you know, we're X number of years into it. Back when the iPhone was launching, it made sense for Apple and Google to, you know, they had different product lineups. They had different agendas back at that time. Google wasn't really, I don't think they had announced that they were doing Android or the phone or anything like that.
Right. Yeah.
At that point, they got a lot of good exposure out of the launch event. I mean, if you remember that keynote, Google was all over that thing when they announced the iPhone.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a big event. It's a heavily covered tech event. So there was a big advantage to Google to be the map app of choice and the email app of choice on the iPhone to have that integration and support. They got what they wanted out of that. They've moved on. They developed new products. I mean, this is just business. Essentially what, you know, Jeff is saying is this is just business. This is just the way it goes. And they'll continue to have a business relationship. It's just not going to be as chummy as before. It's moved into that next phase where, hey, we'll license your technology, you license our technology. This is a business deal.
Right.
You know, and Apple is doing the things, you know, we saw that announcement of the Mouth to Map thing. I think that's just Apple covering their bases so that if a business deal goes south at some point, I don't think it's saying the business deals are going south. It's just Apple's investigating other technologies, making sure they have plan Bs and being smart about their business. And I think people want to read a lot of stuff into that. But, you know, I think Google still has a way head start in terms of the iPhone and in terms of their map functionality. I think it's the best out there. And Apple typically wants to do, you know, deals with best in class whenever they can. I mean, I think that's why we got Intel when we got Intel. But that doesn't necessarily mean Apple's, you know, married to Intel for forever. But, you know, for now, it makes sense for them. And it's this business stuff. And I think for now, Google makes a lot of sense for Apple. The landscape might change in a couple of years, and Apple will have options.
Yeah, I think you hit exactly on what I was going to say, is that, you know, Google Maps, that's what everybody uses outside of maybe MapQuest. But that, for the most part, I feel like most consumers feel that Google Maps is the most, you know, forward-thinking solution for mapping right now. So, and it, you know, makes sense for that to happen. And if we're going to talk about, you know, Google Maps, we should also talk about the new augmented reality applications that are on the App Store. You know, Urban Spoon, one of the most popular, it's been out there. Was Urban Spoon available day one for the App Store?
I think so. It was one of the first apps I downloaded.
Yeah. So the application that lets you shake and find a restaurant in your area, they now have an augmented reality view built into the application, which is pretty cool. Although,
okay, you said the key word there, cool, because I have to ask. I haven't seen what Urban Spoon has been doing, but I played around with, you know, the Yelp one that was kind of a Easter egg kind of thing.
Where you have to shake it for like 10 minutes and you look crazy.
But so the question I'm getting at is, has anybody found that in particular that one of these augmented reality apps has lived up to kind of the hype of some of the things that you thought they would do? Or I haven't seen one that's kind of been like, oh, I would actually use this mode as the primary mode. It's kind of gimmicky. It's kind of cool. It's a funky, you know, it's a really cool party trick when you're hanging out with friends. But at the end of the day, eh.
Well, I'm going to say, first off, I feel like the Urban Spoon implementation of this is probably the weakest of all the apps that recently added this feature. Layar, they've also, is this just, I feel like it's an exclusive, just so I haven't heard about this except for with the with regards to the augmented reality, this has a much better viewing mode. It looks a little better. And also Wikitude, which I think is really cool, because I'm all about the Wikipedia. And I know it's, you know, for some people, I can't trust Wikipedia, but I know none of the people listening think that, but, you know, some of the people I talk to, you know, I think that's really cool, especially if you're traveling. You can, you know, this works pretty well. You move around, and of course, I'm in Cherry Valley. That's where my office is, Cherry Valley, Illinois. Nobody knows where that is, but, you know, and even in Rockford, there really isn't a whole lot interesting stuff to be found on the Wikitude app, but, you know, it tells you about all the towns and you can tap on them and it, you know, oh, okay, there's Malta, Illinois. Never knew about, you know, them, and I can read their, you know, their Wikipedia page from this application. But, you know, going back to what you said, it is kind of gimmicky. I don't feel like, I mean, you're going to look like a nerd holding up your phone.
But, and, you know, I think it has promise. I mean, I think one of the apps that one of the first times I ever saw it was that video that I think probably everybody saw. I can't remember the developer, but it was at like TechCrunch 50, was it, a couple years ago, something like that. And it was kind of like walking through downtown Tokyo, and you could hold up the phone,
oh, right,
and it would point out not only points of interest, but, hey, there's a sale going on over here. It was like actually like seemed like something like, oh, I could actually use this. You know, if I could throw this up and boom, there's, you know, there's a 20% off coupon at this restaurant over there. Hey, I'm hungry, you know, and especially if it was linked into time. And I mean, there's a lot of promise. There's a lot of very interesting things that you can do with it. Right now, I think we're kind of seeing the, you know, the original, hey, we can do this now. We're not really sure what we want to do with it, but we want to show that we can play with it. And it's sort of like an additive. It's fun. Like I said, it's a parlor trick. But I'm glad they're actually showing up now, because I think we are going to see at one point that we're going to see that killer app that you're like, oh, this is the perfect application of this technology. And I just haven't really seen the perfect application of that technology yet.
Yeah, I feel like it is, you know, it's still in its gimmicky stage. It still needs, you know, a lot of time to evolve. But at some point, I feel, you know, we will get to that point where we can, you know, walk into the mall and, you know, put the, you know, look around through our augmented reality goggles and see, you know, what's there and what's, you know, I think the big deal for the augmented reality is it's kind of, you know, it's location based search without the, you know, need to search, you know, right. It just shows you all that relevant information for where you are right now. So I think in the future, I think it'll be, you know, much better. But for now, you know, I think there was another augmented reality application that was recently, announced that, you know, let you look at, you know, restaurants and all that. So maybe if you're, you know, if you're at a train station or something and you're thinking, oh, I don't know where the stuff is in here, you know, I'll just pop it up and look around and, oh, okay, there's, you know, whatever restaurant that you want to go check out. And, you know, I can see that, like you said, there's a lot of promise for it. So what do we want to talk about next? Apple's.
I will throw in. Okay. You know, I don't know if this is technically augmented reality, but one of the ones that have you guys seen the new Freeverse game, Fairy Trails?
No.
So it's augmented reality in the fact that it uses whatever background, you know, you're taking video of as a background for the. It's a little game. Basically, you capture fairies, these invisible fairies, but you can only see them through the iPhone screen, right? So you scroll around with the iPhone and these fairies appear and you tap on them. I think it's targeted at young kids, but you know, it's a 99 cent app, and that's a pretty neat little application. It kind of adds presence to the game you're playing and you know, adds an element of, oh, there's this, you know, this sort of this magic mirror device where I can, if I have this iPhone, I can see these fairies in my environment and capture them. So I thought that was a pretty neat application, one of the more creative ones I've seen so far. If you, I don't know if that's technically augmented reality or not.
I think it is. And if we had, you know, if we had Callie Lewis on, she would tell us, you know, all about it. She loves the augmented reality stuff. But yeah, I feel like, you know, this is, it is an interesting use. I'm looking at it right now. Fairy Trails in the App Store. $1.99, you know, it's not, maybe not an application for adults, or not an application that Jeff would own up to having.
You know, I'd be okay to fessing up to having it.
It's a Freeverse game. I mean, that gives it credit.
So how
right
bad
there.
Can it be?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I feel like that is augmented reality. So let's talk about Apple supposedly shipping. I think the tech press immediately glommed onto this one and said that Apple is shipping jailbreak proof iPhones. When in reality, I feel like it's, I think the title should read jailbreak resistant, because what they did, they changed the, it's the bootloader, right? And so, right. And that's what I'm identifying that correctly, right? It's the bootloader that they've changed. And generally they don't change that, on a device that's already been released. So in the past, Apple didn't change it for the iPhone, the original iPhone, and they didn't change it for the iPhone 3G, but they've changed it for the iPhone 3GS, which means it's not vulnerable to the same, you know, magic that the dev team uses to get in there and jailbreak. Well, they, you know, they got their hands on one of these new quote unquote jailbreak resistant phones, and they were able to jailbreak it, but it's a tether only kind of jailbreak, which means that it has to be connected to a computer in order to boot up because of the way they modified it. And of course, I believe the second generation iPod Touch had the same kind of thing initially happen when it was first released. They could jailbreak it, but it would only boot up if it was tethered to a computer. Now, I'm not sure if that means you just have to have it plugged into a computer that's running, you know, the iTunes interface for the phone, or if it actually has to be running some kind of magic dev team stuff on there. But they were eventually able to figure out how to work that in and make it so you could reboot your phone without having it being connected to a computer. And I guess really there isn't a whole lot to be said about this other than the fact that, you know, the cat and mouse game is still underway, and that it also brings up another good point that, you know, I think I was talking about this earlier, that, you know, the 3GS, it requires signed software past 3.1. So it's signed actually for each individual phone, and the dev team had been cautioning everybody, you know, everybody who ever wants to maybe jailbreak should jailbreak their phone, their 3GS, while they still have the chance, so we can take that, you know, special magic number that's in there that Apple uses to, you know, make that signed package, so we can have that in our database and allow you to jailbreak in the future. Thankfully, you know, for everybody who has updated to 3.1 or later, which includes 3.1.2, there's currently a jailbreak out for, you know, 3.1.2 iPhone 3GS. It works on the it works on that phone and that software. And I don't jailbreak really. But I'm considering doing it just for the simple fact that if I want to later on, I'll be able to do that. So anybody who ever thinks they might want to jailbreak their 3GS, you should do it. And I know that's not something we usually recommend. But that allows the dev team to, you know, keep your phone, you know, from being, not being jailbroken.
Okay. So again, cause I'm really slow and I saw this and I didn't quite. So does this mean there's like a new variant of the actual hardware that's different than the iPhone 3GS that I have now? Or was this simply a software change they pushed out with the latest updates?
I believe it's just a firmware
unjailbreakable thing. You know, device, supposedly, quote unquote.
I believe it's a firmware thing. I believe it's a software,
okay,
not a hardware difference, because they're using, okay, they're using iBoot. They're using a different version of the iBoot,
right,
software on there.
Right. So now, if I understand correctly, that means if you already have an iPhone and you do all of Apple's software updates, it replaces the previously jailbreakable, so to speak, versions with this new bootloader that is more resistant to jailbreaking.
No, I don't, as far as I know, Apple, I may be wrong, so someone will call me out on this, but I don't think that Apple has ever been known to update the bootloader on phones that are out in the wild for reasons I'm not sure of.
Okay.
Okay, so it is software. It's just not pushed out to older devices. It's just showing up on new devices.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Now I get it. That's where my confusion was.
Okay,
that's,
yeah,
where my confusion was coming in.
Yep.
That's where this story was losing me. I'm like, did I get this? Did I not get this? I don't really care because I don't jailbreak, so it doesn't. You know, I'd be fine if they wanted to switch out my bootloader. I don't. Whatever, as long as my iPhone works.
Right.
If, yeah, they can improve my battery, then yes, thank you. I'll take it.
Yeah. But, yeah. But
I guess there's a lot of jailbreakers out there though, right?
Did we talk about the Pinch Media stuff? I'm almost positive we talked about
that. Sounds familiar,
the numbers,
but, you know, keep in mind 2 days after I do something, it's probably completely gone from my memory anyhow,
usually about 30 seconds for me. But yeah, so to just, you know, briefly go over that. There are, according to Pinch Media, they have software running in, you know, certain developers' applications to, you know, track usage statistics. And they have found that, you know, they started figuring out that, you know, at some point, sales numbers wasn't lining up with actual users. And they thought, oh, it must be broken. And they finally realized, oh, okay, it's, you know, it's pirated apps. And from what they can tell, they've received data from approximately 4 million jailbroken devices. And about 38%, or around 1.5 million of those, have used pirated applications.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, so how many, what is the total number of iPhones that are out there now, supposedly?
Oh, Jeff, I think Jeff might know better than I would.
30? Eight, bigger than 30 million?
800 billion.
let's say 30 million. Just,
sure, that sounds
just because it's an easy number to work with.
Okay.
So that, and that's probably in the general ballpark.
Yeah.
And so if 4 million are jailbroken, that's a significant percentage.
Yeah.
If we're getting our numbers right. I'm hoping our numbers are wrong because, I mean, that's not trivial. That's not as trivial as I would have thought it would have been.
I think they, and let me, I'm working to pull up these numbers. You guys can keep talking, but it looks like, yeah, I feel like they did have the numbers for how many iPhones, you know, what percent of iPhones they're tracking have jailbroken. But I'm not seeing that number. What I am seeing, though, is very interesting that, you know, location-wise, the most of the applications are being, you know, most of the piracy is occurring outside of the U.S. Most of the piracy is occurring in China, Russia, Brazil, Mexico. They feel that it's, you know, negatively correlated with per capita, you know, national GDP. So Japan is the lowest. Great Britain is second lowest, and USA is the third. But it's still very interesting. And, you know, we've you know, heard a lot from developers talking about, and I think I have a story here that just came out from Newsweek talking about how, you know, the App Store is not, you know, the gold mine that Apple makes it out to be. And, you know, you've seen these videos. If you follow the keynotes, you've seen the developer of DZB, you know, for example, talking about how he's traveling the world, you know, on the money that he's made selling games on the App Store. And the same thing goes with, what was the game? It's not, was it Trism? It wasn't called Trism. It was a different game. One of those similar puzzle games that was initially announced with the App Store. But they talked to, you know, one developer that that I'm friends with, David Barnard of AppCubby. He makes an application that I love called GasCubby, and he was talking about how he was losing money on his applications, you know, to start off. And this, you know, we'll have a link in the show notes to this this Newsweek article. But you know, at some point he and his wife had to sell one of their cars to get by because he was developing apps for the App Store. Of course, when he finally came out with GasCubby, you know, his numbers went up, and he's positive on his money. But he says that, you know, after looking at it and analyzing, you know, how much time he spent and, you know, what it boils down to is that he's, you know, kind of working at an hourly wage of around $10.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we all do that if we're software developers.
Yeah.
If you really want to deep analyze how much you work versus what you actually get paid, you just don't want to go down that road. But my question to you is the AppCubby app, how much does that sell for? Or the GasCubby app?
GasCubby, looking, it sells for $6.99.
See? Okay. Here's my theory is that you cannot make money developing a 99-cent app. It's just not doable.
Right. I think we all agree on that.
I think this is where the problem a lot of developers are getting into, and a lot of people who are looking to do app development is, you know, if you're looking at developing an app, you want to be looking at something that you know you can sell for $2.99, $3.99, you know,
at
upwards.
Least, yeah.
Yeah. If you're looking for it to be a profit center more than just a supplemental income, there's that occasional hit that might make it with 99 cents. But, you know, I think a lot more thought needs to start going into app development and finding your niche and getting an app that, you know, has a value. Most of these apps, actually, frankly, I have a ton of 99-cent apps on my phone that I would have paid $5 for.
Yeah, me too. You know, we were talking about
and
Ramp
that's
Champ.
Lost, and that's $4 of lost inventory for that developer.
Absolutely.
And I know that some of the complaint is how the iTunes store is set up, and they feel they have to do it for promotional purposes. But again, I still would argue, you know what, if that's the way you think you have to go, then I would seriously take a look at not releasing the app and going, okay, how can I market this outside the iPhone, outside the App Store so that people can get to it, people can find it, but will still pay me the, you know, you don't want to get into that I need to be on the top 10 list game where you're dropping your price, because I think, you know, we've talked about this. I think once you and a developer has dropped their price, they've just valued their app. Even if they say for limited time, how many apps do you know that are on the store that say 99 cents for a limited time and have been there for a year or longer?
Yeah. According to that Newsweek piece, they say that 3 out of 4 paid applications are 99 cents or less.
Yeah. And you know, I would just argue, don't learn from everybody before you. Don't go down that road. And you know, 99 cent app is not going to be the way to riches for sure.
I think that's
fine if you want to do them. If you want to do them, great. We'll buy them. But just know that that's not gonna let you quit your day job.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of the problem with the App Store is that, it's very diluted right now with so many fly by night developers who are just, you know, popping in there to try and, get a piece of the pie of this, you know, this, App Store gold rush. And there really is no gold.
Yeah. That's what people need to understand. You know, this is not a get rich quick. And I think there are a lot of, like you said, fly by night people who are thinking it's the path to fame and riches and quickly realizing that at 99 cents, it certainly isn't. And you need to put more effort into your marketing plan and more effort into your pricing model and your business development before you put that app out there.
Yeah. Yes. According to, the Newsweek article, Gedeon over at Icon Factory said, you know, in a blog post, speaking as a small developer who's been releasing Mac software for over a decade, the App Store is broken. And I would agree with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that. So I don't know if we want to get down that path again.
No, I don't think we need to go down, that path.
But yeah,
you know, this, you know, the article does not shock me.
Right.
And I'm hoping we'll see a change. I'm hoping that we'll see developers realize that, you know what, I can sell my app for $3.99, $4.99 if I figure out, you know, how I'm going to market it and how I'm going to get my name out there outside of, you know, Apple, because Apple's not going to help them. And I think there's too many developers that are thinking that, you know, Apple needs to go in and fix it. And, you know, it's just too big for Apple to deal with. Apple has no mechanism. And you know what? At the end of the day, they're getting their 30%, whether it's $1 or $2 or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Apple's getting their cut, and they're getting their cut from everybody that has an app on there. So, you know, their bottom line, they're not super incentivized to help developers. And I don't say that to be harsh or anything like that, but, you know, Apple doesn't have to be your friend.
Yeah. And I think that most of, you know, I said that the problem is dilution. And I think most of the dilution isn't from just the fact that there are so many applications. I think it's that there are so many bad applications.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, I just want one other quick note based on this Pinch Media story. You know, a lot of people who do pirate applications claim, you know, that they're using it as kind of a try to buy.
That's bullshit.
It is. Well, according
to I'm sorry. I'm gonna have to bleep that one. Make the time marker, but that's a total cop out.
It is, absolutely. And this, you know, study points it out. It says that in what they've seen, the average light to paid conversion is approximately 7.4%, or, you know, 1 in 14 people do that, compared to, you know, the pirate kind of model, the conversions are approximately 0.43%, or about 1 in 233 installations of the pirated applications.
Yeah, how about that?
Have some, if you're going to be a pirate, have some pride and just say, yeah, I stole the app.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, some of this is, you know, talking about how the App Store is kind of broken. And a lot of it to me is, you know, I'm trying to defend these developers. Because, you know, I think we all have personal relationships with some of these developers, and we know them, and it's tough seeing, you know, all these pirated applications and seeing them not, you know, making the money that they should with these fantastic applications.
Yeah, the jailbreaking thing is tragic.
And I don't want to blame, you know, jailbreaking, and I think the Pinch Media guys, you know, I think it said something like 38%, only 38% of the jailbroken you know, phones have ever run, you know, a pirated application as far as they can tell. So it's not.
But that's a large percentage. I mean, you're if you're talking 4 million phones, what's that? That's one. It's over 1.5 million.
Yeah, yeah, it is definitely.
But
that,
apps.
But that does, you know, say that, you know, people don't just jailbreak for pirating. You know?
Oh, absolutely not. No, I think most people don't jailbreak for pirating.
Right. Yeah.
I would never read that into this, but it certainly is.
Well, I know because we're going to get emails about it.
No. And I wouldn't. Yeah, no, absolutely not. Most people are jailbreaking to get features and functionality that Apple won't let them have. Most people I know.
I agree.
They want apps that are blocked in terms of functionalities and feature sets that Apple's, you know, denied. So I think that's the most common reason for jailbreaking. Certainly, pirated apps are available. And if they are, there's a certain percentage of people that are going to use them. There's nothing you can do to stop that. And so I guess getting back to the developer thing, yeah, you feel bad for these developers. But again, if they've been, unless they're just iPhone is their first foray into selling software, they know this is a problem. This is a problem for every software company out there. You know, pirating is just, it's been around since we were, you know, cutting notches and floppies and you know, back in the Apple II days.
Don't
right?
copy that floppy.
Ah, the good old days. You know, there's so many people out there that don't really understand the value of these products.
Right.
And I'm not talking simply about the money. I'm talking about the value of what the application can do, the value of the time that the developer had to put into the application. People don't get that. And so for a lot of people that are pirating applications, I think they really just don't understand the implications of what they're doing. And it carries over to other markets as well. Okay, so as an example, when I wrote my book, within a month of it hitting store shelves, I was already finding websites out there that had taken a copy, torn the spine out, scanned every page, and were offering it for free online.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you can't stop people from doing it.
Yeah, in the age of digital, this is, you know, this is really a social problem that has to be tackled a whole different way, because it crosses every form of media, every form of, you know, if it's digital, it's copyable, and no matter what you do, and that's why, you know, DRM has been such a failure. You're not going to stop this stuff. So the best you can do is approach it from, you know, the product and the price point standpoint, and also probably it's going to take, and I hate saying this, but, you know, government stepping in and doing some things, probably more on an educational basis at a very early age, to get into people and just, you know, get the morals set that this is just something you don't do. You know, yes, it's possible. Yes, it's easy to do. But guess what? We don't do it because we're civilized, moral people, and it's just not something, you know. Probably easier said than done, but that's probably the best we're going to be able to do at this point. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle in all forms of media.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, Apple kind of proved that, you know, with the iTunes Store, as far as music goes, the iTunes Music Store goes, mm-hmm. that if you offer an incredibly easy solution with, you know, reasonable price points, then most people are going to be honest and pay for the stuff.
Yeah. So the best thing to hope for is a reduction in those percentages, right. You know, so that 38% going down to 10%.
Do you think that in-app purchasing, opening that to free applications is going to help mitigate that?
Probably not, unfortunately, no.
I would like to think that it would, simply because people that would otherwise say, well, God, I really would have liked to have tried that out, but I couldn't. So I just went ahead and got the pirated version so I could test it. But then it goes back to what Adam said where, okay, then it becomes a bullshit excuse.
Right. Well, I mean, you have to think about, you know, I think a really good example of an app that people would want to try before they buy would be a turn-by-turn GPS application. You know, I have a friend uh-huh. who jailbreaks his phone because he wants to customize it and, you know, wants to keep tethering. He doesn't do it because he wants to pirate applications, but he downloaded the TomTom app. For free, because it's $100.
No, I'm kind of laughing on the tethering side of things.
Well, who knows if it, you know, who knows if the TomTom app works, and you know, if it works well for you. And we, you know, we talked to Merlin, and you know,
he doesn't. Sorry, yeah, go ahead.
He said that, all the turn-by-turn apps that he tried out didn't really work out well. And that's, that's his experience, and, it's certainly valid. And he spent a couple $100 on apps that don't work. And I'm wondering if, obviously TomTom could, if they wanted to, make an application that relied on, a try before you buy in-app purchase kind of deal. But it's challenging for applications like the TomTom app to figure out how to do that. Because how do you offer a GPS application that's of limited functionality? you have it only speak in a foreign language.
It gets you near where you want to go.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this on the tethering. If AT&T offered tethering for a price, would he buy it?
I think he would have to answer that question himself, but
probably, but so there's going back to that original thing, there's all kinds of forms of pirating, right?
Right. Yeah.
So people who are using tethering on their iPhone right now, that's stealing bandwidth. I mean, that's pirating bandwidth.
True.
Because normally you would have to pay for that.
Now, what about people who use the NetShare app?
Yeah. Same thing. Yeah. I have that app on my phone. I've used it a couple times. So I'll admit to it.
Yeah, NetShare is handy to have, especially if you've updated to because.
I do know that once it's offered, and again, I probably haven't used that app since it came out. I used it a couple times, more of as a proof of concept. And again, that's people can call bullshit on that, and it's probably true. But I really, it's too inconvenient to use. Actually,
that's right.
The advantage of that application. If it was easier, I probably would use it. But when AT&T does decide to offer tethering, if it's at a reasonable price, I'll probably buy it. If not, I'll probably just live without it.
Well, when I actually used it, 2 weekends ago when I went, when I was on vacation, and the NetShare application, because I had updated my phone and I couldn't use the built-in tethering.
Let's not delude ourselves. That's pirating bandwidth. I mean, we're
okay. Yeah, for
bandwidth.
Sure. But I want to say that, on AT&T's end, they generally require you to set up some kind of monthly subscription to it. You can't, it's not very ad hoc. Most people don't need to use, tethering on their phone. They don't want to reduce to that point, because for the most part, when they're home, for example, that bandwidth is available to them by other means. But in a traveling situation, they want that. And it kind of AT&T is setting it up to be somewhat inaccessible, I think on purpose, yeah, for sure.
It's all justification. It goes back to what I'm saying. The solution to this problem is really education. To me, to have the mindset that, I'm already paying AT&T through the wazoo. If I just use this tethering app for 5 minutes, it's not really bad. Right.
I have no compunction about saying that I steal AT&T's bandwidth, and I don't think you guys do either.
Right. But
there's a lot of people that try and justify.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Is we have to get our society out of that mindset that this is even an okay behavior for even 5 minutes. It's like, back in the day, pulling a song off of Napster or anything else. A lot of people did it without even thinking that it was even wrong.
Right,
and it is. It's wrong. But we had a society that didn't feel that way.
Yeah, we say they should offer it, so we're just going to take it. And like you're saying, it's a moral issue, but I think that also, again, will kind of push AT&T in the right direction. I think that they definitely do want to offer more services, because that's how they make more money. But it all of this is collectively pushing AT&T in the right direction. Whether or not it's right is kind of a different argument. I don't know if we want to get into that totally, but
no, we could spend all day on it.
Yeah. So I think that's, that about wraps up, I think, what we have to talk about. Let's talk about, our iPhone picks of the week. Adam, you said you wanted to talk, have a double pick.
Do I need to do a double? Cause I didn't do one last week.
You're allowed to do a double. Yeah.
The first one, I don't travel that much, but for some reason these last couple months I've needed to travel. Do you guys use, and I just found out about this, I don't know why, but do you guys use TripIt?
No. What's that?
Oh,
I don't use TripIt, but I know what it is.
Oh my goodness. Okay. So TripIt is this little app and web service. And basically what you do is you go and you make your hotel reservations wherever you make them. So in this case, for this trip, I made it directly from the hotel. I made my airline reservations through Expedia. Doesn't really matter. And, you know, you get that email confirmation. Mm-hmm. So TripIt gives you an email address once you've signed on and registered to it. I think it's called, I won't give out the email address. It's on the TripIt website. But they give you this email address that you forward all of your confirmations to. And then it parses and scrapes that and plugs it into the application. So then you install the iPhone app, and when you pop it up, it shows all your upcoming itineraries. Oh. You click on it, and then it gives you all of the information for your flights, including your confirmation numbers and all that information. You can check your flight status right from the app. And it does the same thing for your hotels, your rental cars. It even throws in some extra features, like it'll give you a map of the location you're going to, directions to and from the airport, and loads that all right into your phone, just automagically. And it was like incredible, like how fast this information went in and how actually accurate it was.
Wow.
And then they have a little thing in case it does get something wrong, you can submit, you know, an error. So they're constantly trying to improve the application. About the only thing that I was a little bummed about is, like, with my Expedia, it picked up the Expedia confirmation number, but not the airline confirmation number, which was the one I needed for checking in.
Right.
But yeah, you can go into the app and it has a note section. So I just, you know, copied and pasted over the additional information that I needed. But it got, you know, 95% of the info I needed right into the application without me having to do anything other than forward an email. And about the only other thing I wish it would have done was, it does give you the map of the location and the map to and from the airport. It'd be nice if the application would throw in a 7-day or a 5-day weather forecast.
Oh, that'd be nice.
For the area that I'm going to.
Oh, this is killer. Yeah. Wow.
But yeah, I don't travel that much, like I said. And then I heard about this app and I had a couple trips coming up, and it blew me away. I was like, okay, this is so cool.
Can you put extra information in there, besides, you know, that kind of travel information? I see that it has, you know, map of Chicago in one of these screenshots. Is that something that you can email to yourself?
Well, like I said, if you're going to that location, it automatically includes that in the application. So you have an extra little link that shows a map of, you know, Chicago. So if you were traveling to Chicago, you'd have your flight, you have your hotel, then you'd have the map also there. And again, directions to and from the airport or directions to and from your hotel, that sort of stuff. So it just automatically, you know, throws that stuff in there.
And so this is part of a website called TripIt.
Yeah. And then they have the iPhone app, which, you know, culls it all together in a nice little, you know, handheld interface for you to deal with.
And that's free.
It's free. The whole service is free. Everything else.
Awesome. TripIt. It's free in the App Store, one word. And Adam, you said you have another pick.
Do I have another pick?
Do you want you don't have to.
I might have to save. Well, you know what? I'll do this other pick. You know, I'm not a this is actually, I'm going to do it cuz a listener sent this to me, and the history of this application is really interesting. So, I'm not a photographer. I work for a photography company, and I know a lot of people who are photographers. But apparently an important bit of information, if you're going on location to do a shoot, is to know the, like, time of day that you have sunrise and sunset. And this is all for lighting and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah. Moonrise and moonset. And also, I guess, the elevation, like how the sun will be on the horizon and at what angles and degrees the sun is at that time. So, you know, I'm sure some photographers are going to write in and correct me on all this stuff. The azimuth, is that right, of the sun? Do you know any about any of this, Jeff? You photographer at all? But like the, you know, the elevation of the sun, the degrees, and what time. And so this little app is called Focalware. And what's great is this guy originally wrote it for, back in the day, for graphing calculators, or for calculators, I think. And he wrote me and he's like, you know, could I turn this into an iPhone app? And I said, yeah, I don't see why not. And it's now on version 2, and it, in addition to being, I guess, extremely useful for photography, it is also just gorgeous. So you bring it up, it has a little wheel, and you literally just slide sun around and you put it at the degrees. It has this location aware, so it'll find your location based on GPS. You can save different locations. So if you have, you know, favorite places you go to, and based on date and time, it will give you all of this information about how the shadows are going to be, where the elevations are, you know, what the degrees of the sun are. So you know what your lighting is going to be like in a given location at a certain time on a certain day. And, you know, it's just, it's a beautiful app. And I thought he deserved credit because he literally, he put it together in a few months. And then the first version was, you know, definitely version one. And this latest version, I think, is just beautiful. He also added support for the compass. So you, if you have a 3GS, that's built in as well. And, you know, picking your location has Google Maps integration. So
man, it's really that looks nice cool. Stuff. That looks really cool. You are right. It's a very beautiful app.
Yeah, he's just done a great job with it, and he really deserves credit. So if you're a photographer and you know what this stuff means, because I don't, and you can use the app, take a look at it.
Focalware, and it's $9.99 in the App Store.
Yep.
Jeff, do you have an iPhone pick for us this week?
I do, and I even have a backup pick in case the one that I've just chosen we've already talked about. Have we talked about the CNN application yet?
I don't think
nope.
So.
Okay, well, then that's my pick for this week. And I'm sure that there's all kinds of people right now that are freaking out. What do you mean? That's $1.99 for a news app that has ads in it. Well, okay, yeah, so it does. But you know what? It's a fracking awesome application. and it's totally worth the $1.99 that it costs. The application is running up really smooth for me. It's quick to load. You can watch live video right in the application, and the push notifications it does are very timely. Unlike the AP News app, where my running joke is whenever I get a push notification from the AP News app now, I assume it's going to say Farrah Fawcett has died. Because that's, I mean, the AP News app, the push notifications are so slow on that. You know, like with Balloon Boy this last week. Okay, all that happened just a few miles north of the TMO Central Towers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I happened to be out away from my place when that was happening, so I couldn't watch on television to see what was going on. And so the AP News app was not giving me current information. So I was relying on Twitter, and I'm reading tweets from people in Chicago to figure out what's going on just a couple miles away from where I am. And I thought, oh, this is ridiculous. So I'd heard people say the CNN app works really well. So I thought, okay, great. Downloaded it, and I'm watching the live footage from the helicopters with the balloon and watching it hit the ground and all that. And it was all in real time, and the push notifications have been coming through in a very timely fashion. I've been very impressed with the app.
So you were able to watch the live video from the Balloon Boy stuff right on your right with that
yeah.
app?
Yeah, right on my iPhone.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm looking at the little review quotes that they have here from Gizmodo. It says, CNN's iPhone app makes other news apps look lazy.
Oh, absolutely.
Very cool. $1.99. CNN Mobile.
It's totally worth the $1.99.
Cool. Thanks. All right. So I think we need to throw a game in there. So why not? I'll do that. My pick this week is called Edge. And I'm surprised we haven't talked about this, but, you know, I looked and it didn't look like I have talked about this yet. It's a game from a company called Moba Game. And you may have heard about it on iPhone Alley, because it's been a little weird in that someone claims to have the rights to the name Edge.
Oh, that's right. That's how I knew this app. I knew I knew this app.
So it's been...
It was actually off the store, yeah.
Yeah, they pulled it from the store. It went back, and then it was pulled again. And now, very recently, it was put back on the store. It's one of my favorite games because it's so... interesting. It's a very unique concept of that. So the game works like this. You play as a cube in 3D space, and you roll around. You roll your cube around these little mazes, and the goal is to get the little power ups and make it to the end of the maze. And it's it's just so much fun. I'm describing it can't do it justice. You really have to, if you go to iPhoneLA.com and search for Edge, you may get a lot of other stuff. But if you search in the reviews, you'll see a gameplay video of us actually playing the game, so you can see what it looks like. It's very cool. It's very fun and very addicting. And it's only, it's $5, and it's well worth the $5. It's got great sound effects. It's just, it's a very neat application, and I'm very glad that it's back in the store. Hopefully it doesn't disappear again. So it's called Edge, $4.99 in the App Store, and that is my pick for this week. And with that, I will say that you can go to iPhoneLA.com for more news, tips, and reviews every day. If you have a tip you want to share, a news tip or an iPhone tip, go ahead and hit the contact us link on the side of the page for the show notes from the podcast, including our iPhone app picks. Those are all listed at iPhoneLA.com/podcast. And you can send us feedback to podcast@iPhoneLA.com. And you can find Jeff Gamet at the Mac Observer, MacObserver.com, and the iPod Observer at iPodObserver.com, and of course, Twitter.com/JGamet. Thank you so much for being here, Jeff.
Hey, sure thing. And I'm always amazed. Every week I get to come back. So
I know,
thanks.
I know. And Adam Christensen is at the MacCast podcast, MacCast.com, and of course, Twitter.com/MacCast. Thank you so much for being here, Adam, and sticking around with decent Skype quality.
Yeah, I get to be 99.5% Cylon free today.
Awesome. It was good good having you. And you can find iPhone Alley on Twitter at twitter.com/iPhone Alley. And with that, another iPhone Alley podcast is in the can.
An internet. How are we going to communicate this? The stylus. We don't want to carry around a mouse, right? So what are we going to do? Oh, a stylus, right?